Questions in, ask them kind of underneath us on Channel 9 Live, and we'll put Scott on the hot seat. So Scott, maybe to just kind of start things off, tell us what the big announcements were today.
Well, we're doing our Developer Connect event here in New York, and had a bunch of great content throughout the day, talking about our next generation of features with VS 2015, Visual Studio Online, Azure, .NET 5, ASP.NET vNext. So it's been a pretty packed day in terms of capabilities. I think also, and then I kicked things off with the keynote this morning, where we also announced some fairly big announcements that I think probably overshadow each of the individual features. but in particular, one of the things we announced was that the .NET Core, which includes the CLR, our core-based class libraries, the garbage collector, the jitter, you know, everything that's necessary to make .NET applications and code run, that we're open sourcing, and which is a huge step. And basically now means that, you know, starting with our compilers, to the CLR, to the base class libraries, to our higher level frameworks like ASP.NET and data and APIs, it's now 100% open source, which is a huge, you know, a huge announcement. We also then announced that we're doing an official distribution of the .NET Core for not only Windows, but for now Linux and Mac systems as well. And so that basically means you can take that same server-side open source stack that we now have with .NET, and you can basically build apps and deploy them not on, just on Windows servers, but also Linux, and you can even do your development on Macs if you wanted to. And then the last announcement we made was around a new version of Visual Studio that we're calling the Visual Studio Community Edition, that we're going to make available completely for free. And you can think of this as the feature set and functionality that's in Visual Studio today, as opposed to, say, VS Express, which is a subset. So it supports the ability to have multiple project types open at the same time inside the IDE. It has full VS extensibility support, so you can run extensions like VS Vim or XUnit or ReSharper or anything you want inside of it. And it's completely free. You don't have to join a program. Basically, for any individual developer, it's now free to use for commercial or non-commercial reasons. It's free for anyone in an academic or a training environment, so online course, a student, a professor, that's all free. It's free for anyone that's working or contributing to an open source project. So if you're a team of people that are working on an open source project, it's completely free. And then we're also making it free for companies that have sort of five or less developers working on projects, again, commercial or non-commercial. So we think it's really kind of a fantastic offer. It really eliminates any friction required to get the best development tool on the planet. And the combination of that, plus the open source announcements, plus the cross-platform announcements, I think makes it a really great day for .NET developers and Visual Studio developers.
Yeah, it's been great seeing the excitement on Twitter. There's a bunch of folks kind of still in kind of disbelief. And I think some of the comments are almost like, what's Microsoft's motivation behind this? Or why are they doing this? Or this seems too true. Is this, you know, related to this comet asteroid thing? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, since the very beginning of the company, I mean, the Microsoft was founded as a development tools company way back when. Our first product was, you know, the basic interpreter for lots of different platforms. And, you know, I think, you know, our whole history has really been focused on how do we make developers successful. And, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, that we're looking to do is, as the, you know, the world increasingly, you know, software is really at the heart of the new, you know, world economy in a more broader level. I think it's, you know, one of the things I said earlier today is it's never been a better time to be a developer. And, you know, we want to basically, you know, provide the tools and the capabilities that developers need in order to be successful in this new world. And so, you know, the set of announcements today hopefully are really good. And, you know, I like when people say, gosh, it almost seems too good to be true. That means we did something right, hopefully. And, you know, and I think it's going to make us, be even more relevant in the broader space of development, not just for all the developers using us today, but I think with today's announcements, there's a bunch of developers that don't use our technology today that we immediately became very interesting for. And I think that's going to allow us to have an even deeper conversation with a wider set of developers. So So hopefully everyone wins and it's a good set of announcements.
So it's not just for, hey, you're an existing customer today, but this now gives us a way to target to customers that maybe would have said, hey, I have a Mac, there's no option for me to even do development.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen, we've talked to a couple of people, obviously, before today's announcements, just to kind of sound out the impact. And, you know, I think we heard a lot of different things, and we heard pretty much 100% positive. I don't think we heard anything negative. But, you know, it was interesting, some of the reactions amongst, existing developers that are using our stuff that said, wow, this is going to make me use it even more, which was nice to hear. A lot of enterprises have hybrid deployments of Windows and Linux and this and that. They've got lots of different technologies. Mm-hmm. And so they've got development teams and operations teams that run Linux workloads today. And, you know, several of the customers that we talked to that do use our technology today, but only use it for part of their team, you know, immediately said, this is going to make us look at possibly using .NET for everything or for many more projects than we do today, including kind of our non-Windows projects. And then also, you know, we've heard from a bunch of people, including some names I probably can't mention, but that are, you know, have never used Microsoft development technology or have not in the last 10 or 15 years, that are completely Linux operations that don't buy any of our development capabilities today, but say, wow, I'm going to seriously look at it because, you know, hey, we're having this problem with whatever technology they're using. You know, we know that the CLR and C Sharp and the core capabilities you have are rock solid and you know, are good, and you've got great development tools. So, wow, in a weird way, I can now suddenly use you as part of my workflow.
That's awesome.
And that's nice to see, because that's an audience that never would have, I think, looked at us in the past.
Right.
And now we're immediately, I think, very relevant in that space. And, you know, I think it's going to hopefully be great for all audiences.
Great. So, you know, this is also about your chance to get questions answered. So I'm going to go to some of the questions here. And the first one, Chad, has probably the hardest one, which is, how many red shirts does Scott Goo have? So do you have one? Do you have a winter wear, a summer wear? How's it work?
I actually have quite a few. So they kind of rotate, and okay. I've got a couple that have like a badge of honor, like, oh, I've used you for some talk that I remember, and I just, you know, it's thread worn, but I can't convince myself to throw it away. So I don't know, I probably have like 15.
Okay. You need to start putting some of the older ones on eBay and be like, as you saw in the 2009 tour.
I have a good 4 or 5 that are in my core stable that I use today. And then I've got ones that have, you know, sentimental value for whatever reason.
Oh, that's great. So we really do need to find some charity thing to give them to. I guarantee there'll be 4-figure bids. So Tim asks, with the constant churn of frameworks, how do I ensure business applications today will be maintainable in 5, 10, or 20 years?
Good question. I think one of the things that we focused on, really throughout the life of .NET, we announced .NET almost 15 years ago. 14 and a half years ago, I think now. And so, you know, I think it's still cool that if you dig up my, you know, PDC talks from 14 years ago,
the code still works.
The technology and the code still works. I mean, we made a few changes after the initial preview, but, you know, if you look at .NET 1.0 code, it still works.
Right.
Backwards compatibility is something that we very much focus on, because we recognize for a lot of applications, having that kind of rock solid, it will just work, guarantee is important. And we do provide, you know, many, many year support agreements for the frameworks and the libraries and runtimes we ship. And in general, you know, all Microsoft products have a standard 10-year support guarantee on mm-hmm. that. At the same time, you know, the technologies evolve and, you know, new developer technologies come through there. And so while we want to basically provide good guarantees around reliability and that your skills are going to, you know, and code will still work, you know, for a decade or more, you know, we want to make sure that we're continually integrating the best of practices and best of breeds from the broader development space into our technologies as well. And that's, you know, that's why you do hear from, you know, hey, this project or that project and those types of technologies. But we try to, you know, be thoughtful about it and make sure that we maintain that compatibility, which is super important. You know, and at the same time, make sure that we can kind of stay on the bleeding edge and that our developers never feel like they're falling behind in terms of what's best practice.
Sure. Now, Zachary asks...
And concretely, it means that with VS 2014 or 2015, when you open up a project that you have running in VS 2013 or VS 2010 or VS 28 or VS 2005, it just works. Mm-hmm. And we do test that and we verify that specifically. And so, you know, people should rest assured with VS 2015, which is the release we just announced today that's coming out next year, you know, that compatibility bar very much maintains.
Yeah, I think the crazy part is all the versions of Visual Studio are side by side, so somebody could literally have all four flavors of Express for 2005, 2008, and all the Ultimates, and have 15 Visual Studio SKUs, and they would all work side by side.
Yeah. Believe it or not, we test that.
there's somebody with a just terrible compatibility on their remote desktop. So back to the customer question. Zachary asks, is there any certain details on how VS Community 2015 is with Windows 10? So, you know, there's been a lot of excitement around Windows 10. How does Visual Studio and Visual Studio Community and 2015 fit into that?
Well, VS 2015 obviously work on Windows 10. It works with Windows 8. It works with Windows 7. So it works with a wide variety of versions of Windows. But it certainly works with Windows 10. And I haven't actually tried it out myself, but I believe it works with the current preview as well. It should work. So you can use them together. There's a bunch of Windows 10-specific tooling that we'll also come out with that we haven't talked about today.
Right.
And so there's many more improvements coming as well as part of the VS 2015 release, specific for Windows 10. And you'll continue to see us talk about that even more in the months ahead.
Okay. Peter asks, why has no one mentioned F-sharp in the presentations? Is this language still in use in Visual Studio?
F-sharp's definitely still in use. We have a lot of customers that are using it. In terms of the announcements today, I didn't see all of them, so I'm not sure if someone mentioned it. I don't think I mentioned it, but at the same time, I didn't really mention much language in my work. Mm-hmm. Or in my talk, it was a little bit more focused on capability. That's cross-cutting. But it's certainly the open source announcement that we made today applies not just to C# and VB, but to F# and any of the teams that are built on top of the CLR.
Okay. So by benefiting the CLR, it lifts all boats, if you will. So Amir asks, what is the future of Azure Cloud Computing and HPC? So, you know, Scott, maybe talk a little, because probably last time we had you on, you know, you are now Mr. Executive Vice President of Cloud and Enterprise. So how's your kind of job change, and how do you see kind of the overall big picture on cloud computing?
It's keeping me busy, the job. But
are you sleeping?
Not much, but no, it's been fun. But, you know, I think with HPC and cloud computing in general, if people don't know, HPC stands for high performance computing.
Right.
And there's a number of features that we've released on Azure and some new set of VMs that we even released a couple months ago that are specifically aimed towards high performance computing and have some of the capabilities around InfiniBand networking in particular, which for a lot of HPC workloads that are looking for kind of very fast bandwidth or very high bandwidth, fast latency networking configurations we now support. So I think it's our A8, A9 series VMs. We also have our new D series of VMs that we're seeing a lot of interest in for HPC workloads, as well as our new G series, which are kind of our Godzilla SKUs that are kind of up to half a terabyte of RAM. And so in general, you know, we definitely are seeing lots of people do HPC workloads. They vary, again, there's a couple different patterns inside HPC. Massively, you know, embarrassingly parallel, their specialized workloads, et cetera. You know, we're looking to enable all of them inside our cloud.
But just to kind of summarize, like when somebody says, what's Microsoft's Azure cloud computing story? Like, you have to summarize in a couple of bullet points. Where do you see, like, hey, here's what we're trying to do?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we see this paradigm shift that's happening in the tech industry. And there's sort of really two that are happening. One is kind of moving to a mobile first strategy, and then the other one's moving to a cloud-first strategy. And you know, the fact that they're happening both at the same time makes it even kind of more exciting and interesting. And on the cloud computing space, you know, it's an amazing time where any developer now, you know, can basically build an application and have millions of users using it, and can do it with no upfront cost, and can scale it out on a global cloud infrastructure everywhere around the world. That's never been true before.
Right.
And you know, that's pretty darn exciting to be a developer in that time period. And if you look at new trends like big data, machine learning, Internet of Things, you know, there's all these trends that are happening and all these new approaches, which are fundamentally not just changing development, but also, you know, fundamentally changing the way businesses actually operate. And so whether it's with, and software is really at the heart of it, and development is really at the heart of it. And every company going forward is going to be a software company. And so, you know, regardless of whether you're in manufacturing or whether you're in retail, you're going to have applications that you want to engage your customers with on the mobile and web platforms. You're going to be using IoT to track things. Mm-hmm. You're going to be able to use big data and machine learning to look at defects and, you know, forecasts and estimates. And you're going to need developers to do all that. And, you know, I think increasingly more and more of those solutions will be powered by the cloud. And so that's kind of where our vision of the cloud's going, is how do we provide this really robust, really powerful cloud that lets, you know, customers do all of that and do it really successfully.
Great. So Jeremy asks, is the Windows OS team at Microsoft now using Visual Studio to build Windows?
They are. I mean, it's one of the big things that we've done internally is we're moving to what we call kind of the one Microsoft engineering system. Historically, we've had teams that have each had their own kind of build systems, their own test environments. And, you know, one of the things we're looking to use Azure and the cloud for is how do we provide kind of one engineering system that we invest in heavily internally and use for all of our products to build and you know, debug and test. And, you know, for some of our products like Windows Server or, you know, Windows, you know, it's probably the largest software project on the planet in terms of lines of code and in terms of, certainly in terms of complexity of build scripts. I think we had over 1 million lines of build scripts with Windows. And we're moving to this new engineering system. Now, what's great about it is the engineering system is going to be running on VS Online. And so it's the same service that we will ultimately provide to all of our customers. And it's the same bug and work item tracking that we offer today. It's the same source control system we offer today. And the improvements we're making around being able to do, you know, builds and tests for, you know, products that have hundreds of millions of lines of code, you know, you'll be able to walk up to our website and use as well. So yeah, it's the entire Windows team is basically moving on to it. And that started, we've been starting this process about, I think we're about 6 months into it. And I think we just moved the build system over this month as part of it. So it's exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely. Fabulous Fads asks, does Scott allow the Azure engineers to sleep? Seriously, this is awesome work, but I worry these guys aren't human anymore. Great stuff there.
Thank you.
Can they sleep now? Are they allowed to after, I guess, next deployment? Or?
Well, it's funny because we actually have a deployment of a whole bunch of new Azure features that we did not announce yet today that I think hits at 2 p.m. Eastern, so which is in 5 minutes.
5 minutes, great.
And so the next wave rolls out this afternoon. So at some point, I think on the plane ride back tomorrow, I'll do a big blog post and announce it. But yeah, we're on a fairly fast clip. I mean, it's people do sleep occasionally. But, you know, what we've tried to do is, even just within our engineering processes, is really move to a much more continuous delivery model. And so, you know, we're pushing all of our teams to deploy and deliver features at least every week. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we want to get down to multiple times per day. And it's not, you know, you're not shipping a massive new thing every day. But, you know, how do you provide sort of this agile, continuous delivery motion? And be able to take the signal and the feedback from people that are using it to continually improve the product so that you don't go a year or two without getting feedback. You get feedback every single day on the latest bits, and you can course correct and tweak in a much more kind of lean, continuous way. And, you know, I think that's part of the success we've had with Azure is kind of adopting that model. And, you know, once you do that, you start to build stuff that people really like because you're getting the feedback faster. And, it, you know, that's part of the reason why it feels like, my goodness, there's something new every day, and it's cool. That's a good problem to have, but it's more that engineering change that we've made. And it's not just a cultural change, but it's also a technical change. And so things like the VS Online service that I mentioned Windows is adopting. Mm-hmm. You know, all of our teams internally within Microsoft are moving towards, you know, specifically with that goal of moving into that kind of cadence model.
When you talk to, I'd say a certain class of customers love the cloud, they're on the cloud, maybe they've been on our cloud for a couple of years. Then you talk to another group of customers that say, listen, we're an enterprise. The majority of our applications, you know, whether they have concerns about data or they have concerns about their application should really just be inside, because it's more the business to business, if you will, like mm-hmm. meaning it's just to their employees or B2E style applications. What do you tell them in terms of what opportunity there is for cloud for kind of the enterprise customers for looking at cloud development?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, I think you know, one thing we've certainly focused on is having a hybrid story that allows people to both integrate with existing solutions they already have on premises, but also to basically write to a common design cloud architecture design point that lets you run both on-prem and in the cloud. And so that's something that's kind of unique, I think, about the Microsoft cloud story, mm-hmm. is having that type of consistency between on-prem and cloud, and that gives people kind of the maximum set of choices, if you will, in terms of flexibility of options. And we certainly recognize there's going to be some customers, either they're in super, super regulated environments or just don't feel comfortable yet moving a mission-critical system to the cloud, where having that option is a key important thing. We announced last month at our cloud event in San Francisco that Satya and I did, our cloud platform system, or CPS, which basically is an integrated hardware and software appliance that you can install on premises, and it basically gives you kind of cloud in a box, if you will, mm-hmm. And it's fully tested hardware software solution as one example of if you want to basically take that kind of cloud design footprint and run it inside your own data center with your own control. You know, having said all that, I do think for enterprises, you know, I think you're going to start to see, and we're already starting to see, a pretty big shift as more enterprises that a year or two ago would have said public cloud, that's for startups, that's for right. customer-facing solutions, are starting to really realize how impactful the public cloud will be for their enterprise workloads as well. And, you know, part of it is, I think, really two things. One is, you know, recognizing cost savings. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I can now save a lot of money this way. There's also an element, I think, around agility, which is never having to wait to provision something again, and being able to kind of immediately stand up any infrastructure, any applications, and tear it down when you don't need it, also just sort of unlocks a lot of productivity within the organization, within IT, because they can now move much faster than the traditional procurement cycle and approval process for buying new hardware and buying new tin. You know, I think the biggest thing then that we're just starting to hit, that I think in the next 2 or 3 years in particular will be very profound, is new use cases that, you know, enterprise or IT 3 years ago would have said, oh, that's more like science fiction. you know, now increasingly are not just sort of becoming popular, but they're becoming essential to actually compete in the modern economy. You know, if you
what's a good example there?
Oh, take big data as an example,
sure.
or take machine learning, you know, which again, I think 2 years ago were, you know, futuristic science fiction stuff. But now if you're a large company that's doing anything marketing related, anything logistics related, anything financial related, you know, if you're not storing the data from all your transactions and running machine learning on top of it to do predictive analysis or to better figure out who should I target with this marketing campaign, or, you know, what is the defect rate of my manufacturing parts, or logistically, how do I deliver this bits, you know, this box from there to there? You know, if you're not doing that, you're at a competitive disadvantage versus your competitors that probably are. And, you know, that's starting to change, you know, a lot of organizations as they start to realize, wow, you know, we can get 10x more out of our marketing dollars when we run predictive analytics on the target audience. You know, we can actually improve the quality of our manufacturing when we actually are, you know, have IoT sensors and we're actually incorporating data and doing real-time analysis. And so those use cases, as they kind of become less futurish and become more competitive differentiators, I think it's going to drive a lot of IT solutions to the cloud, because a lot of these systems either require a level of storage or a level of compute or a level of global scale that traditional data centers in an enterprise environment just don't provide. And so I think increasingly you're going to see more and more of even sort of the workloads just naturally gravitate to the cloud as well. The same way that, say, websites for organizations as well as mobile backends for mobile apps, you know, have kind of naturally gravitated to the cloud because they tend to be ones where, you know, lots of people are connecting from the public internet. You know, I think big data, IoT, machine learning, streaming analytics, you know, those are the next set of kind of core enterprise workloads that I think will gravitate as well.
Those are super interesting. And you mentioned the example where Windows is kind of using Visual Studio Online. So what about some of that? Where do you see, because now thinking about our organization, where would we dog food some of these machine learning? Or where do you kind of like kind of scratch your head and say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had, you know, apply these IoT big data machine learning to our own data or our own business?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing a couple things. On the machine learning, the big data space, we run with Bing and with a lot of our online properties. You know, we store probably more data, and I would say probably Google and Microsoft store more data than any other organization on the planet, partly because search engines just require a whole bunch of storage and data.
Right.
And so, you know, we have exabytes of data that we store and process and need to be able to reason over. And a lot of the work that we're doing, whether it's with HD Insight, which is our Hadoop service in Azure, or with our machine learning service that we just launched, you know, is about extracting learnings from running our own big production systems and actually productizing it for anyone to use. And so the you know, that whole mantra that we've had for a while of like eat your own dog food,
right,
and run your business on it, that's part of the reason why we have Windows building Windows now on top of VS Online as opposed to a separate system. Similarly, it's the reason why the new MSN homepage instead of apps that just went live, you know, is running on Azure. It's using our DocDB NoSQL store that we just launched that's still in preview. And, you know, Office 365
oh, wow,
and others,
huge.
You know, they're running not only even on our cloud, but often on our preview editions of our services, partly because we know if we can basically meet their scaling needs and their reliability needs, you know, we can probably meet the needs of any application out there. And so, yeah, you'll continue to see us use that model pretty aggressively.
You know, you mentioned DocDB and how MSN is using it. For folks maybe not familiar with DocumentDB, kind of what is it and what are the scenarios one would use it for?
Yeah, DocDB is a JSON-based document store. So it's a NoSQL service, and it's a managed service, meaning you can basically... you don't have to do patching, you don't have to do backups,
right.
All that's kind of built into the service. And it's, you know, it scales to hundreds of terabytes of storage. And you basically just put in what we call capacity units, sign up for capacity units in the system, and you can basically scale it pretty much linearly. And you can do SQL queries on top of JSON documents. We index on the way in. And so we do smart indexing. So if you, you know, if you've got a JSON payload and you've got lots of different columns or properties, and you have multiple of them, you can actually do joins and searches, you know, across multiple of those documents, and not have to do kind of an explicit index scheme. So we're pretty excited about it. We think it's a pretty compelling NoSQL store, and yeah, you can sign up and start using it on Azure today.
Very exciting. Back to some of these questions. Glenn asks, if I come up with an Azure-hosted app and it is suddenly a huge global hit, how do I protect myself from a huge bill and going broke? Smiley face.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you build an app and it's a huge global hit, it's probably a good thing. But, you know, there's a valid question, which is, okay, how do I make sure I don't get a surprise bill? One of the features that we have in Azure today is called billing alerts that you can sign up for. And so what you can do with a billing alert is you can pick a subscription and say, hey, if the bill ever goes above $100 or it's on track to go above $100, send me email. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably the best bet so that if you have that truly global hit that everyone in the world's using, you know, you can very quickly set up an alert and say, ooh, my bill just went north of where I was expecting. What do I want to do about it now? You know, that's probably, you know, the first step I'd say in terms of making sure you have no surprises. The new Azure preview portal that we're working on also does, I think, a pretty good job of integrating billing data directly into the management experience. And so now every time you create a service, every time you sign into the actual portal, it shows you your current bill, it shows you, you know, what services you have running, it shows you what the expected spend is throughout the rest of the month. Also as a way that you can track on an ongoing basis what your bill is. And then we're also exposing billing APIs that allow you to, with kind of REST calls, query for billing data, and provides a kind of a good way that you can kind of track programmatically what your billing consumption is.
Okay, awesome. I love the billing APIs. I'll set up my Twitter so that way everybody will know just how just how cheap actually Azure can be, for especially for Azure websites. So Scott, we are out of time. Really appreciate this. You know, this video will be live online, and coming up next will be Soma, which you can continue to ask live Q&A questions for. So thanks, Scott.
That's great. Thanks.